You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, Donald Trump and Afghanistan.
We made a terrible mistake getting involved there in the first place. We had real brilliant thinkers that didn't know what the hell they were doing, and it's a mess.
That's what the US president said when he was campaigning, but he will today come out with a fresh vision on how the war in Afghanistan should be prosecuted. Or will he? My guests Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including terror in Europe. Members of the terrorist cell in Barcelona and the attacker in Turku, Finland, were of Moroccan origin. We'll consider the role of the country and its subjects in Islamic extremism. We'll also look at the border standoff between India and China. And as the US experiences a solar eclipse as I speak, we'll hear Samira and Tim's recommendations for what you should or could be doing during this extraordinary phenomenon. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. The Catalan police have just announced that they've shot dead the main suspect in last week's Barcelona attack. 22-year-old Yunus Abu Yaqub seemed to be wearing an explosive belt when he was found by the police. He was suspected, of course, of driving the van into dozens of people on Las Ramblas. Last week, Europe witnessed two terror attacks. In Finland, a man armed with a knife killed two people in what the police there are treating as a terrorist incident. What's emerged is that both the main suspect of the Barcelona attack, as well as the man arrested for the attack in Finland, are from or originate from Morocco. Tim Marshall, let me ask you first of all about about Morocco. It is certainly striking that many of these very young men in this apparent cell in the Barcelona attacks, and there were several sort of stages to that, were either of Moroccan origin or Moroccan nationals. And similarly, the individual in Finland. Is that an important fact to address?
Yes. It is, and it's actually not that surprising in the respect of the North Africans are disproportionately represented amongst jihadists in the Middle East, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS. I think Tunisia is the most per head of population. I think Morocco is second, quite a lot in Libya. So it's not surprising when I think it's something like about 1,800 Moroccans are thought to have gone to fight for ISIS. About 900 of them were killed, but about 300 of them are thought to have come back, both to Morocco and Spain. So it's not surprising, because we know there's going to be a lot of this sort of attack now that ISIS has been scattered. There's going to be more of it back in Europe. And so it's not surprising. The Spanish and the Moroccan intelligence services have a very good, close relationship, and they are both aware of this essentially cross-border problem that they have with the Moroccans. There's about 500,000 Moroccan people of Moroccan origin or Moroccans in Spain.
And Samira, it's funny that that's a narrative that's maybe not told or not addressed as often as perhaps it should be, given, as Tim says, that the numbers are quite stark. Is there a degree to which maybe the intelligence services across different European countries, do they risk slightly kind of underplaying or not focusing sufficiently on this question of potential ISIS recruits who hail from, you know, the Maghreb, Northern Africa, call it what you will?
I don't know if any security services in Europe can be accused necessarily of underplaying the threat. I think that we probably hear more as sort of individual citizens. I think we probably hear more about returnees from ISIS when they are citizens of the country that we're in. So, we, you know, in Britain, we hear about the problem of British returnees from ISIS. In France, it's sort of French or returnees to continental Europe, people who can move freely around. I think that's perhaps quite natural. That's also where it's a case of domestic policy making. So it's perhaps slightly easier to discuss and understand. I think that the fact is, obviously, these North African countries, Morocco and Tunisia, which, as Tim says, are two of the highest contributors, were two of the highest contributors of foreign fighters to ISIS, and now have significant numbers of returnees, significantly higher than lots of European countries do. And you know, they're very geographically close to Europe, very geographically close. They're in some cases, like Morocco and Spain, or certain other Tunisia and France, perhaps. There are relationships as well between those two countries and populations and so on. So it is an issue. I think that in terms, as I said, of the sort of domestic policy making, it's citizens returning to their own countries that have been a sort of policy priority. But I don't think that any security services behind the scenes are not aware of the threat.
I don't think that Spain has quite the problem that France has. Spain, I mean, France has about 1 million people of Moroccan origin. Spain has about 500,000. The difference is that in Morocco, people are much more better integrated. There is much, in Spain, much less tension. Mm. And it's interesting that these young guys that have been picked up for this, the town that they came from, until 2 years ago, there was nothing. And then this one individual appears to have shown up, the imam, and he appears to have turned their heads. I mean, you can make the case because Spain has contributed some troops to Afghanistan. It is a member of NATO. There probably is forms of discrimination. So you can make the case and turn them. And that appears to be what's happened. In the Finland case, in Turku, this guy was one of 36,000 asylum seekers, refugees, migrants, who came last year to Finland. He had his asylum turned down because he's from Morocco, and you know, you've got to make quite an argument to say I'm an asylum seeker from Morocco when there's no war going on there, and that might have angered him. But that also slightly goes against this narrative that you take revenge against these evil Western nations, because Finland is hardly a major world player in the so-called war on terror.
And Tamir, I wanted to look in more detail about Morocco. It's interesting that it's always been this, well, they say that the Morocco exception, this strategic kingdom in an unstable region. But there are signs maybe that that's beginning to crack. Obviously, the king was viewed as a very stable figure. And, you know, Islam, no doubt, played a role in cementing that hold on power that he's enjoyed. And yet Morocco now, you know, is largely immune, seemingly, to the upsurges of popular discontent during the Arab Spring, for example. Is that starting to change? And is it important to reflect on that when we look at these returnees or these citizens of Moroccan origin in countries like France and in Spain?
I think that there's several things there to pick up on. Firstly, I think that you know, the fact is that we do live in a globalised world, and you can see from the fact that these sorts of problems, these sorts of attacks, the tactics that we're seeing more and more of, these sort of low tech attacks, which create a huge load on security services because you can't stop someone hiring a van reasonably or whatever, and that's happening not just in one country or one city. It's happening not even just in one continent. That's happening all around the world, and you can see from that the sort of globalized nature of the threats we face of political movements, that they're no longer just sort of country specific or region specific. They become pan-national, pan-continental in a very different way. And so I think for you know, Morocco to be immune from those kinds of forces, which are very powerful regionally, but also globally and continentally and so on, I think is not surprising at all. The kind of repercussions of something like this, the fact that we've had these two attacks in quite quick succession with featuring attackers of alleged attackers of Moroccan origin, can have immediate knock-on effects for Morocco. I mean, there's already talk about the British Foreign Office and other places downgrading travel advice for Morocco in the wake of that. Even though, interestingly, you know, neither of those attacks actually happened within Morocco, we're still seeing perhaps a knock-on effect on the tourist industry in that country. It's interesting.
The 600,000 Brits go. Sorry, I mean, I know
all the time. Yeah.
You have a very international audience, but so, and I would assume the British figures are similar for countries of the similar size. 600,000 Brits go every year. You know, Morocco hugely depends. No, to a great extent depends on tourism. They had an attack in 2004. They had another one in 2011, terror attacks. But that's actually not very much if you look at the history of this century. And you both mentioned the king. He has done quite a good job on trying to bring together what is a relatively cohesive society anyway. I mean, they do have divisions with Berbers and others. So he's done a good job. And also, they insist on having imams who are Moroccan. They will not allow imams to be imported, say, from Saudi or from Pakistan. That has also helped. But there have been various terror cells broken up over the past few years. It clearly is a problem. The returning of from the Middle East is also a problem. And there's a last bit of, well, one last piece of many pieces in the jigsaw. The Rif Mountains is where a lot of these guys come from. The Rif Mountains are very, very poverty stricken. And you do, when you trace back through the Moroccans that have either been killed or arrested for terror attacks, when you trace it back, there's a disproportionate amount of them come from the Rif Mountains, which is the poverty stricken area.
Is there a conflict, and I'm maybe talking metaphorically, within Morocco between elements of society which reflect on the importance of tourism, for example, being seen to be an open society, of the importance of secularism broadly as against a much more orthodox Islam? And is there a danger here that if Morocco maybe does become more riven by tensions, or if the grip of the king and his supporters diminishes, I don't know, it's a parliamentary democracy, but he's still a central figure, that could manifest itself in an even more damaging way?
Well, it could, but I mean, I don't think, I mean, you shouldn't ever be complacent, but Morocco is not front and centre if you're looking at North Africa for threat levels. I think even Tunisia, which is potentially a little bit more secular than Morocco, but because of the problems they've had in Tunisia, they're really having a battle between the secular and the religious and where they're going to go with it. I would put Morocco somewhat underneath that, and bang, top is Libya, for obvious reasons, but also Algeria is probably second. I mean, the Maghreb has not got the attention that the Middle East proper has, but I think that might change over the next few years.
And Samir, just to come back to a point you made about the sort of difficult to police against low-level, low-tech attack with a van. Nevertheless, in this case, this cell were clearly plotting something much bigger. We know there was this gas canister explosion in the house and some other explosive materials which are often used in more complex sort of explosive attacks. With that, with this group of people, with this imam who, whilst he was in prison, allegedly became a confidant of one of the attackers from the 2004 Madrid train bombings, it does start to look a little bit like a pretty serious intelligence failure, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that this, actually the Barcelona attack is quite distinct from other sort of car type attacks that we've seen, where, you know, lots of these attacks, like in Nice, like in London, in all sorts of places, actually it tends to be an individual who might just have looked up some propaganda on their phone, has seen that there's this, you know, there have been specific calls from ISIS leaders to do what you can in your country, take a knife, take a car, whatever. Very individual people doing that. There's often also a very blurred line between sort of genuinely holding radical ideology and mental health problems. We've seen that. It sort of might just be, as Tim mentioned, as a possible motive with the Finland attacker, someone who has some sort of individual grievance or isn't doing well in their own life or has mental health issues. And happens to sort of frame it around this ideology. That's the sort of common pattern we've seen in these attacks, and that's very distinct from what we've seen in Barcelona, I think. As you said, it seems to be quite a coherent cell, lots of people involved, coherent cell sort of organised around one particular person and leader. So that's a very, very different thing.
And already with pretty established links to France, possibly to Belgium and back to Morocco. I mean, this was a proper conspiracy. This was not just one guy going on the call for the stray dogs, lone wolves, whatever you're going to call them.
And of the sort, Tim, that we have the right, no, as citizens, to expect the authorities to detect, given we're talking about an accrual of a large amount of weapons.
Well, there have been far fewer attacks in Spain than in other European countries. It's nothing like what's happened in France or even in Germany or Britain. It's not been the same kind of threat,
every successful attack is an intelligence failure. That doesn't mean you heap opprobrium. You know, I'm not accusing you of this. If heap opprobrium upon the intelligence services, you know, they're looking at 20 at any given time. This one clearly did go. What is still puzzling is when the house blew up on Wednesday, they didn't immediately link there is a plot going, because it's now pretty established that that was where all the three truck bombs, if that's what it was going to be, was going to come from. This house blew up. They said it was a gas explosion. It didn't send enough alarm bells ringing. I think there'll be some problems with that. But going back to your question, intelligence failures, this is the age-old question. What sort of society do we want to live in? We will now inevitably, as well as having various laws that have already been passed, it looks to me there's going to be a lot more bollards placed in a lot more places. I actually saw some today near Buckingham Palace, which I have not seen before. And secondly, you want to rent a van? You better have you're going to be on a police database. Now, fine, I'll buy one secondhand. But, you know, every time something happens, our lives change a little bit more, which is part of the whole plan to get us to change.
Let's continue to the United States next. President Donald Trump will announce his long-awaited new strategy for the war in Afghanistan later this evening. During his campaigning, Trump repeatedly questioned the purpose of America's continued involvement there. However, some experts believe that his primetime television address may include a promise of, albeit a modest increase, an increase nevertheless of US troops in the war-torn country. Samira, we've discussed often, sat in these chairs, Afghanistan and the US's role there. Tricky to second-guess Donald Trump ever, particularly on this issue, but it does seem that people are broadly expecting an increase in troops. Will that make any kind of difference?
I think it's very difficult to predict with success with much confidence, I think, in terms of the mission in Afghanistan. You know, we're talking about probably an increase in the thousands of troops is what sort of seems to be being briefed to various different American publications and so on. That would be well short of the sort of 100,000 or so that were there during Obama's surge when there still wasn't lasting peace achieved. So, you know, I think it's going to be... I personally find it quite hard to believe that sort of Trump's new strategy is going to bring peace where people have been failing for 16 years. And it also, I think the timing is quite precipitous. You know, this is obviously quite long delayed. He's been expected to make an announcement about this for months, and probably because, as was in the intro to this programme, you know, he made a big thing about criticising the campaign in Afghanistan and the failure of all his predecessors and so on. So it's quite difficult to then sort of carve a position out of that. But the timing, that, you know, the way it's fallen is six districts have recently, just in the last few weeks, fallen to the Taliban. You've got, I think just today or yesterday, a government office in one province being taken over by insurgents. And so the scale of the problem is really huge. The bloodshed's really ramped up, like more Afghan soldiers dying this year than in any of the last few years. And so the challenges are big, and it's hard to see anything changing significantly for the better, I think.
Indeed. And Tim, if we look at Trump and his pronouncements on the campaign trail, and again, at the risk of sort of tempting fate, given we don't know what he's going to say in a few hours from now, I just wonder what your instincts tell you about who will be shaping his policy ideas in this direction. Because we've seen you know, the constant merry-go-round of his personal retinue. Is he going to listen to the generals?
Yes, that's exactly what's happened. I mean, all right, if tonight he announces they're withdrawing, I am 100% wrong. I suspect it's going to be a modest increase. Okay, unpack it. Up until February, he was saying, I want out. He's been in chaos since then. Key, Bannon has just left. Bannon wanted out. Now, he's out of the way. What you've now got is the three generals around him. Now, many people are very unsure about having the generals at such a high, although, you know, despite Eisenhower being president, but leave that to one side. I actually think they are probably a wise restraining influence on him from doing something rash. An American pullout overnight would precipitate the jihadist Taliban takeover.
Samir's just been talking about how unstable it remains, even with them.
So, it's the longest war, 16 years, America's ever been involved in. Here we are in 2017. He wanted out, and I think it looks like the generals have said, Mr. President, because we're talking about the head of the NSA, the head of the chief of staff in the White House, and the Pentagon. It seems to me they've come to him and said, Mr. President, yes, really good idea, save American lives, yeah, pull out. But could I just point out to you, A, that the 16 years you will wipe out like that, the Taliban will take over after the partial victory of 2001. And also, do you understand the damage you're going to do to America's credibility, where within your presidency, in the next 4 years, The barbarians will be at the gates of the capital, Kabul. The capital will fall. The president will be hung upside down by his ankles from a lamppost, and people will blame you. And I think he'll have thought, oh, I hadn't thought of that. Because, you know, I don't think his hinterland allows him to think in that sort of global strategic decades-long way. And it seems to me that that is what happened. And now that the ideologues have been partially cleared out of the White House, the generals have said to him, Mr. President, and he said, okay.
Well, and all will be revealed.
Yeah.
What about Pakistan and its role here, Samir? I mean, again, this is a question I think I'm sure I've put to you before. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that from Trump, or if it is the generals to whom he may be listening, will they have counselled him on the critical nature of engaging with Pakistan maybe in a different way and moving that relationship forward, which is so fundamental to the future stability of Afghanistan, of course?
Yeah, they have indicated that it's not just going to be Afghanistan, that they're going to talk about generally remodelling their engagement with South Asia and particularly Pakistan. They're concerned about the terrorist networks that have their base in northern Pakistan and are allowed to operate quite freely there. It's quite well documented that elements of the Pakistani state support insurgency in Afghanistan because they don't want Afghanistan to be a sort of Indian client state. So they've sort of... For many years, many decades, funding those groups, even as they, you know, criticise the Pakistani version of those groups who would then go on to perpetrate attacks within Pakistan's borders. So it's a sort of multi-headed state policy that's not coming from one central body, which makes it very, very complicated for America or Britain or whoever it is to figure out exactly how you engage with Pakistan. Because I think when civilian politicians say we want to clamp down on this, they're not being disingenuous. They do, but they don't have the control over those elements of the security service. And it's not even the whole security service who are engaging in that sort of funding of insurgent groups and so on. But it is there and it sort of operates as its own beast. So it'll be interesting to see what Trump comes up with about that. There's been talk about sort of much closer scrutiny of military aid to Pakistan, et cetera, but I think there's also this awareness, as there has been for many years, which is it sort of binds the hand of different Western powers when they're engaging with Pakistan, that they do need to keep elements of the state at least on side. They do need their support, basically. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't expect any substantive change personally.
You go all the way back to 2001, and there was the Hammer and the Anvil operation. The Hammer was the American forces were going to drive the Taliban through over the Hindu Kush, where they were going to meet the anvil of Pakistan, and they were going to be crushed between these two things. Well, the anvil turned into a sponge and just soaked them all up. And you're always going to have that
terrorist
problem.
Violence ramped up in Pakistan as a result.
Well, the Pakistani elements that do support the Taliban rode the tiger, and then the tiger has come back and bitten Pakistan. So you're absolutely right. Every single policy falls on this, which is why I think this whole thing tonight, 9 o'clock Eastern time, he's addressing the nation for the first time since February. I think it will be a modest increase in troops, and that is simply to save face, to hold the capital, so the capital is still held by the government, there's still a proper functioning state. Meanwhile, more than 50% of Afghanistan is now either contested or held by the Taliban or other groups. You know, they don't actually control the country, but doing this will shore up the capital, allowing the Americans to say, you see, we're not losing.
We've heard that somewhere before, I'm sure, in history. You mentioned India just a moment ago, Samir, and I did want to touch briefly on that now. India's Home Minister said earlier that he believes a border standoff with China will soon end. Indian and Chinese soldiers have for more than 2 months been facing off over a well-documented territorial dispute in the Doklam Plateau, which India says is Bhutanese territory, which China claims for itself. Some analysts say the dispute amounts to the worst crisis in relations between the two nuclear-armed, let's not forget neighbours, for many decades. Tim, you and I've discussed this very instant not that long ago.
And did I not say to you they wouldn't go to war in the immediate future, and they haven't done yet?
Will this latest iteration of this standoff that's been simmering away end anytime soon?
They were punching each other the other day, and I was quite heartened by that. I thought, my God, you've got two nuclear-armed forces at the top of the world. They've clashed, and there was actually fistfights breaking out between the two sets of troops. I was quite heartened by that, because it didn't lead to a nuclear war. I said to you, if they can get to September, when President Xi is hosting Modi, the Indian leader, at that point, they will sort it out. This is sortable-outable, this one. There's an English expression I've just made up. I think there's a danger that they clash at sea in the middle term, midterm future. I don't think they're going to go to war over this. Basically, to try and explain it, if people don't follow it closely, if the Chinese can build at that height a motorway, which is what they're doing, and then drive it down through the valley, at that point they will be able to move their armoured columns right to the very border of India, and then it's a very quick dash across what's called the chicken's neck. So you've got the mass of India, then you've got this little stretch of the chicken's neck of territory, which is India, and you've got the three Indian states above it. So if you cut that chicken's neck, you've cut those three states off from India. That's why they're so angry about it. But as I said, fistfights at the moment are about the level it's going to be at.
And Samira, just briefly before we move on, are you, as Tim, reassured by this, again, this low-tech nature of how this is manifesting itself?
Yeah, it's true. But I think that it's unlikely that it would progress into war because, you know, that these countries, let's not forget, are deeply interlocked in bilateral trade and so on. And I think there's also the fact that no one has an obvious military advantage, I think, so it's not particularly advantageous to anyone to, for all the harsh words and punches thrown, I think it'd probably stay in that sort of arena.
And nevertheless, there could be a flashpoint, as Tim says, in the medium term, but it's more likely to be, for example, maritime in how it manifests itself.
Yeah.
Finally, on today's programme, the US is right now experiencing an extremely rare sight in the sky. It's a solar eclipse, the first such incident to make landfall exclusively in the US, the totality, as they describe it, since the country marked independence in 1776. I don't know whether that's portentous or not. It seems like it might be. According to reports, and this is intriguing, there are a huge number of couples who have waited until this very moment to tie the knot during a solar eclipse. Tim and Samira, I have to ask you both, what do you make of that? And what perhaps would be your suggestions on how they might better be passing their time in the dark? It's a family show, Tim. Nevertheless, people have got very excited about this this solar eclipse. Are you surprised by that, first of all?
I'm in the dark here.
very good.
So over to you.
It seems like quite a terrible time to get married. Everyone will have their attention on something else and it'd be really dark. But my favourite thing is that Bonnie Tyler says she's going to be
total
singing
eclipse,
Total Eclipse of the Heart during
that. That was very good. Thank you very much. On a serious note, though, it is funny. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of media. I've seen some of your erstwhile colleagues from Sky who are you know, at the scene today.
It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I tweeted something earlier. I took a picture of a completely black square with a thing over the lens and tweeted the eclipse as seen from my pocket. I love eclipses. We've only ever in my lifetime had a partial one here. It was weird. It went cold. The earth changed colour and became a sort of brownie. The birds stopped singing for about a minute. It was just weird. And you can imagine going back all those thousands of years how people, of course, they would have thought, oh my God, this means X, Y, and Z. So I think it is a fantastic phenomenon. I would personally love to see it. This is, you know, a really good one in the States. And being as it's in the States, you're going to make money out of it. I mean, there's people, they are in the hundreds of thousands along the path across the country. People are setting up fast food stalls and the motels are full. It's fantastic. As to what you would do in the dark, I have a personal eclipse every night. And so, you know, I'm quite happy with eclipses.
Samira, it is interesting. There is that moment, I guess, in an eclipse where it has this sort of almost end days feel.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the first since the country marked independence, Trump's in the White House. I don't know. Are the gods angry? Or am I being slightly...
I'm sure Nostradamus said something about Trump.
Probably. Am I being slightly melodramatic, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's not not an uncommon take on it, I think, that it's a sign of wrath from the gods, perhaps. But I was reading somewhere today that in 600 million years, we won't be able to see any eclipses at all because the moon's orbit will be far enough away from the Earth that it won't fully obscure the sun, so...
Never let it be said that we don't touch upon the truly thought-provoking issues. Finally, Tim, to you, how will Donald Trump be marking it, do you imagine? Round of golf, possibly? Or
as I understand it, he's getting briefed by a scientist who's explaining to him that this is not some aliens trying to steal the sun, but in fact it's called an eclipse, and therefore you do not need to get a task force out there.
Let's hope he pays close attention. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall, thank you both for being with us here at Midori House today. The programme was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Ferdinando Augusto Pacheco and Sophia Armadi, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. My thanks to them all. More music for you next. Robert Bound is here with Culture at 1900, and more on the main stories of the day, and maybe some more on that eclipse. On the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then. Goodbye.